John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, October 17th, 2012. Israel continues to bombard the Gaza Strip, and seven residents from the West Bank are kidnapped by Israeli troops. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli Air Force bombarded on Wednesday at dawn a training center that belongs to Al-Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of the Hamas movement in northern Gaza. The Al-Qassam Brigade said that the army attempted to assassinate some of its fighters. Local news sources reported that Israeli F-16 warjets fired five missiles into Al-Qassam training center located near residential area in Beit Lahia in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. The shelling led to massive destruction but no casualties. The Al-Qassam Brigade said that the army attempted to assassinate some of its senior fighters, but they managed to escape the shelling unharmed. The brigades added that its fighters managed to fire three missiles into the Eshkol Regional Council in the Negev. Staying in Gaza, Israeli Navy gunboats fired dozens of rounds of live ammunition at Palestinian fishing boats in the Gaza coast and the central area of the coastal region. No damages or injuries were reported. Israel repeatedly targeted Palestinian fishermen and fishing boats in the Gaza Strip. Dozens of casualties were reported. Damage was also reported to dozens of fishing boats. Last week, four fishermen were kidnapped by the Israeli Navy and their boats were confiscated. Elsewhere, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn Bethlehem City, southern West Bank, and searched homes and later clashed with dozens of local youth who hurled stones and empty bottles at them. No injuries were reported. In other incidents, several residents were kidnapped in occupied East Jerusalem and other areas in the West Bank during dawn invasions by the Israeli military. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, October 17th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hussam Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Afghanistan, 17th of October. At least 45 Afghan troops were wounded by a suicide car bomb attack at an Afghan NATO military outpost in eastern Paktia province. The attacker reportedly detonated a vehicle packed with explosives close to the gate at the Zermatt base. Deputy Provincial Governor Abdul Rahman Mongol said most of the injured soldiers were hit by broken glass. Afghanistan, 13th of October. A suicide insider attack by a member of the Afghan intelligence service killed two American soldiers and four fellow Afghan intelligence agency members. The bomber wore a suicide bomb vest under his Afghan intelligence agency uniform. The attack occurred when a delegation, including American soldiers and several members of Afghanistan's National Director of Security, arrived to deliver new furniture to the intelligence office in the Maruf district, a remote area of Kandahar province, according to local officials. Afghanistan, ongoing. The U.S. is negotiating to keep 25,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan after the supposed 2014 withdrawal date. Mr. Barack Obama, this goes on and on. Nothing ever changes. Now is the time to throw in a towel, bring all the troops home today.
University of Notre Dame international law professor Mary Ellen O'Connell is waging a lonely battle, charging U.S. drone strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia violate accepted standards of the rule of law. Since taking office, President Barack Obama has authorized 284 drone strikes in Pakistan. The New America Foundation, a think tank in Washington, D.C., states 3,000 people to date have been killed by U.S. drone attacks. O'Connell's legal arguments are complex and confusing to a public not versed in the rules of combat and international law. Her academic work won important backing from a joint report of New York University and Stanford University Law Schools, which concluded many U.S. drone strikes were illegal since they occurred outside the traditional limits of a war zone. In an interview with the Los Angeles Times, O'Connell observed, "We would not accept or want a world in which Russia or China or Iran is claiming authority to kill alleged enemies of the state based on secret evidence of the executive branch alone." In June, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Killings warned a conference in Geneva that double-tap drone strikes, where a second drone-based missile attack is launched after people arrive to offer aid to the wounded, could be interpreted as a war crime. In defending the policy of targeted killings, White House counterterrorism advisor John Brennan maintains, "We use force consistent with our inherent right to self-defense."
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. The 11th of October, a third activist, Leah Lynn Plant, was sent to jail for refusing to talk to a Seattle grand jury supposedly investigating Occupy protests from May Day. In other words, three people are now being held indefinitely in jail for refusing to snitch on Occupy activists and anarchists in the Pacific Northwest. The grand jury's act of sending a third activist to jail has unleashed another wave of punitive retaliation by anarchists across the entire continent. In Wisconsin, on the 12th of October, two ATMs were smashed in retaliation for the grand jury fishing expedition and the jailings. This communique was then posted. "Friends, we attacked two ATMs early this morning in the Fox Valley of Wisconsin, in addition to dropping two banners in two different cities. Our reason for choosing ATMs is because we don't like them. The banners read, 'We will not forget Derek Williams / ACAB and release the PNW grand jury resistors. Stay strong, comrades.' The reason for this action could be one of a thousand, but we did this specifically to express our rage against the Milwaukee PD murdering Derek Williams and the kidnapping of our Pacific Northwest comrades.
Certain things in our mind cannot be forgiven, and lines must be drawn. Let's keep it coming. In Portland, Oregon, on the evening of October 11th, the same day Leah Lynn Plant was sent to jail for refusing to snitch, a protest march smashed windows at a Wells Fargo bank, a J.P. Morgan Chase bank, and a U.S. bank. A Walgreens also received a smashed window. The cops were unable to arrest any of the marchers, and this is part of a statement later posted to www.anarchistnews.org. Quote, "The judge, the feds, and the state know all too well that Matt, Kideo, and Leah will continue to resist their coercion. These ignorant state officials somehow live in a fantasy land where radical solidarity doesn't exist." Four banks along the path of our march were smashed, including rocks through multiple windows at an Umpqua bank, a large metal chair through a Wells Fargo window, and rocks through a Chase and finally a U.S. bank. The statement ends with the words, quote, "Smash all prisons and banks, topple the state. Solidarity to all in prison, and especially those queers, because we queers destroy with the fierceness. Free Leah, Matt, and Kideo." In Vancouver, Canada, on the 13th of October, yet another group smashed nearly all windows of an upscale restaurant, releasing this communique. Quote, "A yuppie restaurant was attacked, with nearly all of their windows smashed to oblivion. 3 days later, the windows have not been fixed. Anti-Gentrification Front, AGF, will continue our campaign against gentrification, capitalism, and our solidarity will be amped the F up. Go, go, Vancouver, smashy smash. Don't stop now. The rain has started coming down, and soon we'll all yuppie windows." And now here's something from WSQT. "To all you jerks in the grand jury and the U.S. Attorney's Office, keep it up. The more people you jail for refusing to snitch, the harder your masters will be hit as their comrades rain down punitive strikes from coast to coast. On the 15th of October, as over 50 people walked onto the occupied Keystone XL pipeline construction area in Texas, protesters showed up in front of the American Petroleum Institute here in D.C. to support the over 3-week-long blockade of Keystone XL pipeline construction. The folks in front of API carried a symbolic pipeline wrapped in "No Tar Sands" banners while demanding clean energy from Texas to D.C. Here's what things sounded like from a video posted by Earthworks Action on YouTube.
Texas to D.C., we want clean energy.
From Texas to D.C., we want clean energy.
It's just another way to die.
If there's one thing tar sands oil is not, it's clean energy. It's even dirtier than that so-called clean coal that exists only as a myth. In fact, production of tar sands oil can produce so much carbon dioxide as to make it up to 5 times worse than regular oil in terms of global climate change impact. Meanwhile, TransCanada thinks they can stop the blockade with their SLAP lawsuit, or strategic lawsuit against public participation, against 21 people alleged to be organizers of the Texas blockade. They must not understand that SLAP lawsuits breed retaliation both inside and outside of court. October, over 50 environmental activists and Texas landowners whose land is being stolen by TransCanada for the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline swarmed onto the construction site to reinforce the blockade that has now been in place for over 3 weeks since the 24th of September. There were two main functions of the massive walk-on the 15th of October. One purpose was to resupply the tree sit, as the police are attempting to starve out the blockaders who have been in place for over 3 weeks now. The other purpose may have been to punish TransCanada for their strategic lawsuit against public participation, or SLAP lawsuit, expanded to 21 people from the original 19 people in three organizations. Here is the timeline of how things went down on the 15th from the TarSandsBlockade.org website. 8:15 a.m. Supporters rallied nearby to stop the pipeline. 8:30 a.m. A beautiful morning in what remains of our East Texas forest. TransCanada has clear-cut outside of their designated pathway and around the west side of the tree blockade, leaving a muddy path of destruction in their wake. 8:45. Over 50 blockaders walk onto the Keystone XO pathway.
But right now people are moving back and forth along the side of the road, initially moving underneath the tree village, to which the police said everyone had to move back over on this side. And it seems like everyone has complied pretty easily. Again, the police orders were, hey, 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 hey. That's all the police actually said. And so far, everyone's moving along here.
9 a.m. One blockader arrested after sitting down in the path of the Keystone XL and refusing to leave.
They're arresting someone right now. He's cooperating.
Hey, he's got health issues. Yeah. No need to be rough with him. He's cooperating.
The officer did grab him and turn over really.
He's being rough with him.
No, he's fine.
He's fine. Yeah.
So someone's being arrested right now who sat down in the roadway. Police officer did grab him and turn him very, very quickly, even though he was cooperating the whole time. The person does have health issues from what I'm hearing. Right now there is four officers gathered around him. There's one moving along the easement.
Well, y'all, you need to get behind that orange line, or you need to hand him to, please.
So a medic is asking to make sure that the arrestee is doing fine. Police officer is threatening him with arrest. And so the medic is going ahead and moving back.
You're not enforcing any law. You're enforcing a big company terrorizing landowners into giving their land away.
9:06 a.m. Three blockaders have been arrested. We outnumber TransCanada's police 3-1. Two blockaders have locked down the excavator equipment protecting the tree blockade. 9:20 a.m. Livestream videographer has been detained and handcuffed, but they're still streaming. Police are trying to flank groups of protesters.
So it looks like they want us to leave. At least I'm going to go ahead and back out.
Stop. Stop.
All right, I asked.
What do
you want to do? All right. So I'm being detained. I was unclear because my car's word dropped. Can I ask who was giving you orders? Like, who was that dude?
Lorenzo,
we've already been detained, and you were on this side of the white line, which is the right-of-way. Okay, so you understand where the right-of-way is. I'm not going to argue with you right now.
I want to make sure he's comfortable.
Just have Lorenzo sit right there for right now.
All right.
9:45 a.m. Small group of ground blockaders break through the police line and enter the tree blockade. 9:50 a.m. TransCanada supervisors in an ATV shouting orders to their paid police force. 10 a.m. Four arrests so far. Freelance journalist, live streamer Lorenzo Cerner has been released. The rally at the easement near the highway is going strong with chanting, singing, and lots of colorful banners. TransCanada is barking orders at the police. 11 a.m. Today's first solidarity rally in Washington, D.C. is beginning now outside the American Petroleum Institute. 11:10 a.m. Six blockaders have been arrested at the tree blockade. 11:35 a.m. Picture from the D.C. Solidarity Rally. Over 60 people turned out on their lunch hour to stand with the Texas blockade and stop Keystone XL. 12 p.m. noon. We just did a call-in with the Solidarity Rally in D.C. Quote, "We are not deterred by the legal and police repression we are facing. We will continue, and we hope you will help in this fight against the Keystone XL. 12:50 p.m. We have now confirmed that a 70-year-old woman participating in the blockade was thrown to the ground and tackled by TransCanada's hired thugs. 1:55 p.m. At least 8 people have been arrested after walking onto the Keystone XL clear cut in defiance of recent repression. Two blockaders are still locked to a huge excavator in the path of the toxic pipeline. 3:20 p.m. Solidarity rally in Denton, Texas has begun. 3:50 p.m. Two blockaders who locked themselves to Keystone XL machinery have been arrested. A crowd of supporters stood by and cheered for them as they were taken into police custody. These two most recent arrests make 10 total for the day. 4 p.m. Our first arrestee has been released without charges. He was arrested early this morning when he sat down in a Keystone XL's pathway and refused to move. His defiant action helped delay police officers and allowed other blockaders to breach the police line and enter the tree blockade. After he was arrested, he was made to lie face down in the mud for several hours. He continued to refuse compliance with the police, and citing health concerns, had to eventually be removed on a stretcher. He was later released from the hospital without charges. 4:15 p.m., solidarity photo in front of the Trans-Canada office in Westboro, Massachusetts. Thank you. 6 p.m. Six of the eight arrested today have been released from jail on charges of criminal trespass, which is a Class C misdemeanor. The bail was set at $1,500 each, a total of $9,000. The two blockaders who locked themselves to Keystone XL machinery will see a judge in the morning. Here is a first-hand account of police brutality towards participants in Monday's massive blockade of the Keystone XL Tar Sands Pipeline Project's southern leg in Texas. It was published in print on www.tarsandsblockade.org, so I'm going to read it out for you here on the air. Quote, Monday I was arrested at the site of Tar Sands Blockade's tree blockade in Winnsboro, Texas. Though some people attend an action of that size with the intention of being arrested, rather to stop construction activities or create media attention, I personally never intended to land myself in police custody. As part of the blockade's regular ground team, I participate in support operations for those who spend their days and weeks high above the forest floor. Monday was no different, and I entered the woods in full camouflage with several tasks in mind, all of which revolved around resupplying tree sitters with basic necessities, fresh fruit and vegetables, vitamins, warm socks, etc. After a fairly successful morning of fairly undetected movement, I volunteered to try to draw the attention of several police, most of whom are off-duty officers from other counties, being paid very well to assist in starving out the tree sitters so another contingent of ground supporters could send a bag full of materials to our friends in the canopy. Unfortunately, my efforts worked all too well, and in trying to draw a few police in my direction, I ended up drawing almost every police in the vicinity. I made a break for the densest part of a nearby thicket, knowing that most of the officers would be unwilling and unable to follow me through such dense and thorn-laden areas. I was half right. Most of the police wouldn't follow me in, but other police had finally been stationed in the brambles. Every turn I made found me face to face with another police officer, most of whom were whooping and hollering as if participating in a rodeo. All I could hear aside from the crashing branches were calls of, "Hoo-wee, we got a live one, and here we go, baby, come my way." Exhausted and surrounded by roughly 10 or more police joyously waiting to tackle me, I fell to my knees and raised my hands. That's when a larger man, who I later heard claimed to work for the Hayes County Sheriff's Department, threw me to my stomach. He quickly moved around in front of me, placed his hands on either side of my head, and thrust his knee into my mouth. It was an intentional assault, and though it stung, all I could think was, quote, "This is what police do. They brutalize people." He sat on my neck with all of his weight for a few minutes while ripping through the small pack I had strapped to my back. When he stood me up, I commented that the knee to the face was absolutely unnecessary, and the surrounding officers chimed in that they didn't see such a thing happen. With a laugh, I offered that, quote, "Of course you didn't. You like to knee people in their faces, too." As I was loaded into an off-road vehicle, still more police tried to blame their minor scratches and scrapes on me, claiming I should be charged with a felony count of assault against them. I was clearly bleeding more than anyone else in the vicinity, blood I drew myself crashing through thick strands of briar, and I laughed at such supposed tough guys, men so willing to assault an outnumbered and surrendering person, would then start crying foul. The veil of authority so clearly lifted, I witnessed what so many millions of Americans must undergo regularly. Violent and abusive men blaming their victims for the violence they inflicted upon them. I was summarily transferred into the hands of on-duty Woods County Sheriff's Department staff who were, to their credit, kinder. I glimpsed what is perhaps a false impression, that there was something underneath their dedication to a law written and manipulated by the wealthy, a sense of understanding for what we at the blockade are doing. Wood County is rural, and I would imagine it's hard to work for the Sheriff's Department and to not know someone whose land is being stolen, destroyed, and turned into a ticking time bomb. Never did I hear the phrase, quote, "I'm just doing my job," more times in one day. And I reminded every person who tried to absolve themselves with just a moderate and absurd incantation that the worst crimes in human history have all been committed by people who were, quote, "just doing their jobs," and that our jobs do not relieve us of our moral and ethical obligations as conscientious human beings. As the police pickup truck drove myself and another captured friend through the clear cut and back to the road, I was first overcome with a deep sadness. I felt that I had failed my friends, and even that I had failed the forest itself. I have spent many nights in those woods and can attest to their majesty and wonder. I watched the canopy come down at the hand of men operating machines, which could only then be built and utilized in a world as insane as ours. As I viewed the devastation that Trans-Canada has wrought upon that landscape, I began to imagine that devastation running across the continent and was then filled with greater rage and resolve to continue on no matter how many thug police are set in my path. That is the end of the account published on www.tarsandsblockade.org of police brutality towards one of the participants in the Tar Sands Blockade against the Keystone XL Tar Sands Pipeline Project Southern Leg in Texas. Hey, Trans-Canada, don't mess with Texas!
I have heard some people make some very degrading comments about the cops recently, and I personally believe that people should refrain from making degrading comments about the cops, because the cops have a very difficult job, and they do it very well with great pride and integrity. And therefore, I wrote a song in support of the cops, and it goes like this. Come and gather round, you people, now, and listen to me yak. All you doctors and you lawyers and you folks who push the crack, and all you folks who push the buttons and you folks who push the mops, come listen while I tell you how I really like the cops. Oh, I really like the cops. I think they're pretty cool. I like them in my neighborhood. I like them in my school. I think the cops are wonderful. I think the cops are nice. And I like to have a broken jaw and carry a pack of ice. I really like the cops. I think they're pretty neat. I like it when they take my face and smash it on the street, and then they drag me to a station and they lock me in a room, and then I like it when they rape me up the anus with the broom. I really like the cops. They make me want to sing. You know my favorite movie is that tape of Rodney King, and so I really get pissed off whenever somebody like you suggests we should subject the cops to citizens' review. I really like the cops. I am so glad that they're around to hassle me and ticket me for sitting on the ground. I really love the cops. I'd be so sad if they were gone. There's something about a uniform that always turns me on. Yeah, I really like the cops so much, folks, that I don't think you should find out the number of your local cop watch group. And if there is no cop watch group in your town, that's good. I don't think you should start one. And if you're walking down the street and you see somebody getting hassled by the cops, I don't think you should stop and see what happens. I think you should just walk on by, because that person must deserve everything they get for not looking rich enough for the cops to leave them alone. And if you're with a group of people and the cops start picking on one of you, I don't think you should stick up for that person at all. I think you should just let the police physically and psychologically isolate your companion. And I don't think you should carry one of those little disposable drugstore cameras on your person at all times to document police brutality with when you see it. And I don't think your town should have a civilian review board to investigate citizen complaints against cops. And if you do have a board like that, then I think it should just be a rubber stamp committee that approves of everything the cops do. And if there's a cop in your town who makes a regular habit of beating up unarmed people, or raping women at gunpoint, or raping men at gunpoint, or killing people for an adrenaline rush because he is a psychopath, then I think that he should not be fired. And if he is fired, then that is definitely punishment enough for him, and he should not be prosecuted. And I most definitely do not think that you should put his name and his address and his telephone number and his list of crimes on a flyer and post that flyer all over town. And I don't think you should go to his neighborhood and talk to all his neighbors like people do when a convicted sex offender moves into a neighborhood and let them know what he has done. And I don't think that you should egg his house or slash his tires or run him out of town. And I don't think that when he applies for a job on the police force in the next town over the hill, I don't think you should go to that town too and do the same thing and make sure that he never works as a police officer again. I don't think you should do any of this because your town has the best police department in the world. Oh yes, I really like the cops. Just to see 'em gets me high. I hope that I get taken into custody and die. And then I hope that every fact that's in the coroner's report gets chucked into a dumpster so it won't be heard in court. A yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle, a yoodle. I love you, those boys in blue. And when I hear you making statements that you know are quite obscene, like how the cops are nasty and like how the cops are mean, it makes me want to tell you that you ought to get some class and help your local officers by kicking your own ass. So come gather around you people now and listen to me yak. All you doctors and your lawyers and your folks who push the crack and all you folks who push the buttons and your folks who push the mops, come listen right, I tell you how I really like the cops.
Over the past few decades, mountaintop removal coal mining has become a scourge throughout southern Appalachia and many parts of West Virginia and Kentucky, as well as Virginia and Tennessee. In this method of coal mining, an extreme step beyond contour surface mining, millions of pounds of dynamite are used to literally blow off the tops of mountains to get at the coal seams underneath, sending tons of earth and rocks into freshwater streams and creeks below. Larry Gibson, who died of a heart attack in September, first raised the alarm 25 years ago against the practice and the resulting destruction of the land, pollution of the air and water, and the devastation of entire communities. He advocated an end to all coal mining and coal burning because of its major contribution to climate change and its terrible health impacts on local communities. Family members and fellow activists attended a memorial service for Gibson in Charleston, West Virginia on October 14th, where he was remembered as a fearless environmentalist, but even more as a humanitarian who assisted anyone who needed help and who came to the defense of those impacted by all types of coal mining, even the miners who felt threatened by his work and in turn threatened and harassed him. The day before the memorial service, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus traveled to a gathering in Gibson's honor at his ancestral home on Kafer Mountain, West Virginia, which has been mostly destroyed by mountaintop removal mining. There she spoke with Chuck Nelson, a close friend of Gibson's who joined his Keeper of the Mountains Foundation and traveled with him around the country often to talk about their struggle against mountaintop removal coal mining.
And I can still see him, that, you know, he'll be standing there and he said, I come here to make you mad. When I get through, you're either going to be mad at me or you're going to be mad at the issues I'm telling you what's happening. He said, either way it goes, you're leaving here mad. But I want you to be mad and I want you to get out and do something. What people does after they hear Larry is what impresses Larry. Larry's been around a lot of big name people, famous people, people with money. They don't impress Larry at all. It's what they do. You know, what action do they take to try to stop the destruction of Appalachia? Larry, as a child, growing up here and seeing his father work in the coal mines and seeing how hard he labored and how he came dragging in after working a shift and, barely just being able to walk after pulling the shift's work. And Larry seen this at an early age of how the coal industry was abusing their workers, how they took advantage of them. And, even times there was, he's seen where people has gotten hurt in the mines. His dad get hurt in the mines and, you wasn't able to pay your rent because you were staying in a company home and they kicked you out of the home. They evicted you from the house. So Larry lived that, and he seen it early in life. And he knew that he did not want to go through the same thing as his father did and what other miners in earlier years was going through. And so he left here and he went to Cleveland, and he worked for the auto workers up there and stayed there long enough to draw a pension and get his health care. But he always considered this his home. Cave Ford Mountain was his home. You know, so Larry returned, and as bad as it was when he grew up, when he returned, he was just devastated by what, you know, the coal companies was doing to the mountains and to his homeland, you know. And even I as a child remember coming up here and seeing a school, you know, a church, and a big community up here on top of this mountain. And, you know, it's not the same. I mean, that's what Larry witnessed when he come back, that, you know, a lot of his ancestral land had been sold by family members to the coal companies. One time they had over 300 and some acres up here on Cayford Mountain, and a lot of them had sold out to the coal company. So Larry had 50 acres that still remained, and so he put that in a trust fund to protect it, that where the coal mining companies could never get that. And so he would walk out and look, you know, the mountains he roamed through. And, you know, he even had animals as friends. You know, he was that close with the outdoors. And he would roam. This was his land that he roamed, the land that he grew up in. And after he seen what was happening to it, and, you know, didn't just blowing the mountains up, he started speaking out. And this was like over 25 years ago, talking about mountaintop removal and how they blow the tops literally off the mountain and dump the overburden down into the valleys and just destroying community after community. You know, it upset him, and little did Larry know that when he started standing up over 25 years ago, that this would turn into a nationwide movement where people all across the country now are speaking out against mountaintop removal. And I'm talking about big greens like Sierra Club, Earth Justice, NRDC, and Brand Rainforest Action Network. You know, he is the father of this movement. He got this organization, the Keepers of the Mountains. That is something he always dreamed about. And the purpose of it was, it wasn't about Larry Gibson. It was about seeking out people that had stories to tell that didn't have the opportunity. So he was going to give them that opportunity, put them on the road, you know, and let them go to all over the country telling people what mountaintop removal, the impacts that they are feeling in their communities. Larry said there was 1,000 people out there, that there's thousands of stories that these people can tell that they just don't have the opportunity. He said, that's what I want my foundation to do. And he looked at me, he said, you have to promise me that if something ever does happen to me, because he felt like he would lose his life in this battle, maybe not as a heart attack, but, you know, with violence that was taken against him. And, you know, you could ask Larry, and I said, I've heard people say, Larry, are you scared of the violence that comes your way, the way the coal industry sends the miners after you, and, you know, and with shooting his dog and burning his camp down and running him off the road, you know, are you scared? And he said, no, I'm not scared. I'm concerned. When you show fear, it's just like a bunch of sharks. They feed off that. So I'm not, I don't have any fear of it. And, you know, it really inspired everybody who's talked to, especially me, to carry on his message and see that his foundation moves forward and do the work that he wanted to do.
That was Chuck Nelson, who became president of the Keeper of the Mountains Foundation after Larry Gibson's death. Learn more about the communities and organizations fighting to end mountaintop removal coal mining by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Billionaire brothers David and Charles Koch have become well-known in recent years for their financial support for right-wing political causes and their very public personal commitment to defeat President Barack Obama in the 2012 election. Heirs to the oil fortune left by their father, Fred, founder of Koch Industries, David and Charles have over the past 9 years sponsored private retreats where wealthy conservative donors, Republican politicians, and right-wing activists gather to discuss politics and pledge funds for the cause. Last winter, at a 3-day retreat in California, the Kochs and more than 250 of their allies pledged approximately $100 million to defeat President Obama in the 2012 election. A source who was at the retreat reported that Charles had personally pledged $40 million and David pledged $20 million to beat Obama at the polls this November. More recently, In These Times magazine reported that Koch Industries sent voter information packets to 45,000 employees and contractors working for their Georgia-Pacific subsidiary endorsing Mitt Romney, while warning that many of our more than 50,000 U.S. employees and contractors may suffer the consequences if they vote for Obama and the Democrats. Your reporter spoke with Jesse Lava, campaign director with Brave New Foundation, who oversaw the investigation that was the basis for Robert Greenwald's newest documentary film, Koch Brothers Exposed. The film examines the Koch brothers' involvement in polluting industries and the effects on downwind communities, efforts to resegregate public schools, the undermining of Social Security, and the imposition of new laws designed to suppress voter participation. Here, Jesse Lava explains why he believes it's important for Americans to know about the financial power behind the Koch brothers' radical conservative political agenda.
These are two guys who have $62 billion between them, and they use that wealth to keep down what has been metaphorically termed the 99%, or say symbolically termed the 99%. And they do it in a lot of ways. One key way is they use their wealth to create an echo chamber of misinformation. So let's take one issue as an example, Social Security. They've given millions upon millions of dollars to all kinds of think tanks, the Mercatus Center, Cato Institute, Heritage Foundation, and these think tanks put out papers saying that Social Security is going broke. How many times have all of your listeners heard that expression, Social Security is going broke, Social Security is going bankrupt? That's because the Koch brothers and people like them have paid a lot of money to make sure that that's the message you hear. They create this echo chamber by funding these groups to say this, even though it's not true. And then politicians hear that. They put that into bills. Media outlets such as Fox News, but also lots of regular mainstream outlets as well, will put that into their news stories and act as if it's true. Soon enough, you start hearing it so many times because you think, gee, we've got to start cutting Social Security if we want to save it. The reality is that Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus, and for decades, it is expected to remain solvent. The only thing that will make Social Security insolvent is if we cut it. So this argument that we need to destroy Social Security in order to save it is the kind of things that the Koch brothers do in the public discourse to achieve a minimal government and a pro-corporate agenda, where things like Social Security, which is an extremely popular program, they don't want those kinds of examples of successful social programs being in existence. That's why they want to dismantle Social Security.
Now, Jesse, I wanted to ask you about something that was in the news just in the last couple of days. It turns out Koch Industries on October 1st sent voter information packets to 45,000 employees of its Georgia-Pacific subsidiary, saying to the employees and their contractors that they may suffer the consequences of voting for President Obama and Democrats. This is maybe done by some employers at some time through U.S. history and elections, but certainly this is an outlier in terms of the way employers behave, when it comes to an employee's personal choice and who they vote for in U.S. elections, is it not?
It absolutely is. I mean, certainly corporations have political action committees, and corporations get politically active. And they like to kind of hide behind that, say, hey, this is just free speech. The problem is that this is free speech with an imbalance of power. And in that very same article that came out in the magazine In These Times, we had somebody who had given a quote to The Nation magazine and who had said things against the Koch brothers and their politics and working for Koch Industries. And in this article, it revealed that he had been punished for that, that he had applied for a promotion to become a shop foreman in a Koch factory, and he was denied the ability to do that because they said, you're too political. And I think he knew exactly what that meant. He had given this quote to the Nation magazine. So it is a dangerous way to approach things, and it actually reflects the broader problem of unaccountable corporate power and the general problem of weak unions, of workers who cannot collectively bargain, of a situation in which workers are completely dependent on their employers, and employers can say, hey, we're just doing free speech, and it is de facto intimidation.
What's the objective of this film, in addition to alerting us to the activities and the predilections of the billionaire Koch brothers? Is this a call to action, and if so, for what?
Absolutely. We need to take our democracy back, and I know that that sounds gauzy, and you hear things like that all the time, but really, there is something very profoundly important at stake. We're not supposed to be in a plutocracy. We are supposed to be in a democracy. The problem is that most people have no idea what the Koch brothers are doing. For the people who are listening, think about your cousins, your friends, your brothers, your coworkers. Most of them, maybe they've kind of sort of heard of the Koch brothers. Probably they haven't, or maybe they haven't. This has to get out there, because the way that people can fight to get their democracy back is if they know the mechanism by which it's being taken from them. And that's what the Koch brothers are doing. They're precisely trying to take our democracy from us. And with this film, we hope to inspire, educate, and agitate. We want people to show this to everyone they know. Go to KochBrothersExposed.com. You can get a DVD there. You can show. You can do screenings. You can sign up to do a screening where people in your area can come to it. Go and do that so that people understand how their democracy is evaporating. That's how we can get it back.
That was Jesse Lava, campaign director with Brave New Foundation and an investigator on the film Koch Brothers Exposed. Learn more about the film and the Koch brothers' political agenda by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.